If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Anyone who's grown up watching pantomimes in Britain will be familiar with the story of Dick Whittington. At its heart is the rags-to-riches tale of a boy who leaves his home in the countryside and ends up becoming Lord Mayor of London. Not once, not twice, but three times. Few people, however, will realise that Richard Whittington was in fact a real person. A medieval entrepreneur who used his wealth to shape the fortunes of England's capital, and who served as a moneylender to three different kings. It's a story that has long fascinated the author Michael McCarthy, and he's just published the first detailed book about Whittington in 140 years. John Borkham spoke to Michael to learn more about Whittington's life and career, and to find out whether he really owned a cat.
So, Michael, to begin, I just wondered whether you could just give us a very, very brief overview of who Richard Whittington was. I think some of our UK listeners might have a vague notion, thanks to the panto, but it'd be helpful if you could give us a brief summary.
Richard Whittington is not simply of mythology in the sense of the pantomime, but in fact was a very real person, and he was a very significant person in London from the period from the 1380s to his death in 1423. He served as Mayor of London four times. He was a supplier and a lender to three successive English kings, Richard II, Henry IV and Henry V, and did much else besides. Most significantly, on his death in March 1423, he left his entire huge will to be distributed for public and social works. And those works have been continuing under the auspices of the Mercers' Company for 600 years.
Fascinating. Do we know anything at all about his early life?
This is the great sort of conundrum about Richard Whittington. We know he comes to our attention formally as something that we can prove in 1379, by which time he's aged round about 2021 and almost certainly has been an apprentice mercer under the auspices of Sir Ivo Fitzwarren. But there's a great dispute for many years over what the date of his birth was. And 100 years ago, they thought the date of his birth was round about 1350. In fact, his birth date is sometime in the year 1358, 1359. And what we know is that he doesn't know his father, Sir William Whittington. Whittington dies in the year of his son's, his baby's birth. And he is the third son in the family. He's 2 years younger than his brother Robert, who we do know was born in 1356 or 1357. So that gives us a clue to his age. And we're also able to track his age to some extent. And we're helped here by the mythology, by the pantomime story itself, because virtually all the images that we have of Dick Whittington, the pantomime character, is of a young boy round about 12 years of age. He's not a man of 22 or 23 when he arrives in London. So he almost certainly comes into the household of Ivo Fitzwarren as an apprentice, probably aged round about 11. And that's really all we know about him at that stage. In the book, I've tried sort of piece a jigsaw together about what sort of life he would have had as a young boy. He's the third son, so it's inevitable that he will go to London, you know, to make his fortune, as it were, which in fact he does, of course, as we know. But also we can gain some insight into where he was educated. There were two principal schools in the area, the Abbey School, Llanthony Priory. So it's quite likely he went to one of those or was tutored at home from a monk from one of those. And we can also gain some impression from what we know of trading at the age of 10. We know some of the traders in Gloucester, because there are some archives for those. So we know the names of some of the leading mercers in Gloucester. And I've assumed in the book that his mother, now a single parent, would have actually gone to maybe three or four of these people and actually said, you know, can you sort of confirm who are the best mercers to actually send my son to, or better still, I actually know who I'm sending him to, but could you give me further sort of substance so I'm certain in the judgment I'm making?
Indeed. So when he goes to London, does he really have much say in the matter?
Oh, no, I wouldn't think so. Not as a boy of 10 or 11. No, and I think that must have been really challenging. He will have seen, you know, boys from other households, not too many, but he will have seen that in the area. And remember as well that what we've got here is a Gloucester on the one hand, the point of departure, and a London on the other, the point of arrival, that have suffered immense turbulence, really, over the last 20 years since the Black Death. And in terms of your original question, which is what do we know about him in those early years, the other problem we've got is something like 50% or more of the rural clergy died as a result of the Black Death. And it's that rural clergy that were most vital, most essential in actually recording births, deaths, marriages, you know, events locally. And of course, much of that gets lost during the Black Death, and that's fairly typical of England at large, unless an estate has been fortunate enough, you know, to have archived stuff and it's been found, and or maybe whoever was recording it survived the onslaught of the plague.
And how had the Black Death specifically shaped London?
Well, the Black Death had a huge impact on London. So by the time, even 20 years later, that Whittington arrives, London is still a place of great turbulence, great change, but also of great opportunity. Again, London probably lost 40 to 55%. Those are the general sort of figures. So somewhere in the middle, around about 50% of its population. And you were losing many landowners. You were losing many merchants. You were losing senior figures as well as sort of minor figures in the clergy. And of course, fathers, sons, wives, daughters. And of course, you've got the Hundred Years' War in the background that is also claiming lives. So you've got this extraordinary pestilence affecting the capital city. London was probably a city of, you know, 60,000, 55,000, 60,000 before Black Death. And it took about 20 years to get back to around 50,000 in 1379 when we first come across Richard Whittington. In that turbulence, a number of things are taking place. One, you actually get land changing hands regularly because titles have been lost. The lives of those who held those lands have been lost. So what happens is you've got this great sense of flux in who owns what. So there's change there. You've got an extraordinary level of in-migration from people in rural areas, even 20 years on, trying to find work, seeking to make their fortune. You've got a city that is at this time becoming, these are merchants essentially, who are becoming increasingly wealthy, and they're also becoming increasingly forceful in their relationships with the crown and vice versa. So Whittington comes into all of that. But underneath all of this is this sense of turbulence also means opportunity. And when I was first putting this book together, I had an alternative title that I used to have at the bottom of my notes, and I always kept it there. And it was Right Time, Right Place, Right Boy.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does seem like it's very serendipitous, doesn't it? So he becomes an apprentice mercer. Can you just explain what a mercer would have actually done at this time?
Yeah, and it's best to explain it probably when he arrives in 1379. And why he comes to attention is he has enough money in his pocket. And there's a big question, how and why. He contributes £5 to what was called the city's gift to the barons. The barons had all got rather fed up with the city and life in London and had gone back to the shires. And of course, they were desperately needed back to spend money. This is an age of also of growing consumption, growing ostentatious consumption at court, but also among the city merchants themselves. And what Whittington has learned as an apprentice mercer is effectively a trade selling luxury goods. Now, that might be types of wool, that might be baubles, it might be jewellery, it may be, but essentially it's cloth, luxury cloths. And much of the wool that he would have traded, as it were, outside of the court, he developed relationships with Venetian and Florentine merchants who would take this terrific English wool from the area in which he actually hailed, an area called the Rylands. And they would finish that wool off as very fine goods in Italy. And then he would bring it back. And that's where he began to make his mark and make his fortune. So essentially what we see really from 1381 onwards, throughout the 1380s, we see him arrive as a very young mercer in court, very significantly introduced by Sir Ivo Fitzwarren, his mentor, probably his backer, and related distantly as families. And he uses, and this is one of the main features of the book, he uses Fitzwarren's military connections, his military networks. This is the time of the 100 Years' War. And both the father of the young Fitzwarren served in the 100 Years' War, and both the father of Richard Whittington, but more curiously, Richard Whittington's father served as the Banneret Knight under Fitzwarren's father. So there is a connection. And whether Richard Whittington knew that before he left Gloucester for London, we don't know. But he certainly did by the time that he arrived. So there is a relationship between them. And the young Fitzwarren, probably in his early 20s at this time, is immensely well connected at court, really very, very well connected. And he was the ward at court for a time to Edward III's wife. And so he has these doors that he can open. And luxury goods is the trading commodity.
Yeah, so he becomes acquainted with royalty, doesn't he? And he ends up lending them money. I mean, how does that relationship work exactly?
Well, what starts off is of course, he develops the relationships through these networks. So you find him in his early years trading, you know, as a very young man to people like John of Gaunt and to Thomas Beauchamp, Henry Bolingbroke, who's Gaunt's son, and who actually he will then have a very close relationship with some years later when he becomes Henry IV. So he has all these relationships and with Robert de Vere and other favourites of the young Richard II, which was a court of great ostentation. And so he fits in. He's young, the court is young, he fits in. He sort of exercises himself through these relationships and he starts to make money on the trading front. But what then happens, as you rightly ask, is it then becomes known that he's made quite a bit of money. He's very interesting as a character in that he keeps his money liquid, so he doesn't go off buying bits of London, which was almost the city pastime at that moment, and places along the Thames. And what he does is he saves his money. And he makes it known, or it becomes known, that he's got cash in hand. He's discreet. He's trusted. He develops an extraordinary sort of reputation for integrity. And so people approach him, very senior people, and say, can we borrow this? We'll pay you back when. And at times, he doesn't push people for the repayment. He gets it back, but he doesn't push them. And all of that is a very measured style. But it's also, I'm not going to say opportunistic, but it was an opportune moment, and he knew, he was far-sighted and intelligent enough to exploit those opportunities. And that's how he went through life. So you see him right towards the end of his life as offering counselling to Henry IV and Henry V, being responsible for, you know, the building of the roof at Westminster Abbey and things like this. And that's because in these early days, he has shown himself to be somebody of immense trust and integrity. He's a guy of, you know, he says in his will that, you know, I've always seen myself as a very pious and devout man. And the reason for distributing my will in its entirety like this is because I see I've got a sense of social responsibility.
Indeed. And he holds a number of official roles, doesn't he? But how does he first become Mayor of London?
Well, that's interesting. And it's one of the most interesting episodes in his life. He has served as sheriff by this time, and the typical route to mayor is to have served as sheriff 1 or 2 years before. But what happens prematurely almost, he started his civic career in 1384 as a common councillor. So that gets him into the sort of the civic path, as it were. But what happens without design, of course, is that in the summer of 1396, the sitting mayor dies in office, literally in office, Adam Bam, a very popular mayor who had saved London from probable starvation a couple of years earlier. And Whittington is not elected as mayor. He is literally installed by Richard II as mayor. And Richard II at this moment in time is having a very difficult time with the city, and the city are having a very difficult time with Richard II. So Whittington almost is, you know, what's that phrase? Cometh the moment, cometh the man. And he's a well-known figure in the city, very highly regarded young mercer in the Mercer's company. And he's been a common councillor, and he's very close to Richard II and to Richard II's court. So who better in this moment of crisis? And the crisis really offers Richard II and Richard Whittington an opportunity that they both exploit, maybe for different reasons and with different intensity. But Richard II says, I'm imposing him, I'm installing him in this rather unusual circumstance, extenuating circumstance. We haven't got time to have an election. I need a mayor. It's a difficult time for all of us. It's Richard Whittington. And then we find Richardson the following autumn elected. So this is actually where you get the shift that you will have noticed, that he's not three times mayor of London, he's four. So he's the first time it's for the part term, and the other three times it's for the full term. And of course, what's remarkable is this is the summer, John, of 1396. We still find him mayor again in 1419. You know, an extraordinary period, and you know he's about 60. At this time.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable career, isn't it? And there are just so many crowning achievements. What would you say were the biggest successes he made at the start of his term as mayor, and during his first and second terms, perhaps?
I think in the first term, it was stabilising the mayoralty, and it was actually probably taking the heat out of the intensity of the declining relationship between city and crown. And I think he did that rather well. I think over time, the thing that is most striking is his determination to ensure that trade is legal, it's not illicit, that weights and measures are literally that, they're done properly. In his first couple of terms, he takes on the fishmongers. There are groups within the fishmongers who have illicitly trapped fish in certain parts of the Thames where they shouldn't have. So he sort of wades in, no pun intended, on that. He then gets involved in wider issues of weights and measures. As mayor, I think it would be right to say that he was offering sort of economic counsel to each of the kings that he sort of worked with. He was a very sensible, sort of well-balanced sort of character who understood that London was not simply about the crown or the city. It was actually about the common people. And London was a big city, not as big as Paris or some of the Italian cities, but it was still the largest city by a factor of 8 or 10 in England. And those people were largely impoverished. You know, many of them were ill. He developed very early on in the 1390s something that would only ever come to pass a couple of years after his death, which was he developed a huge anger and distaste for London's prisons, particularly for Newgate. And he made it one of his great life's missions that he would rebuild Newgate. And he only finally got the thing we all know about these days, the final planning consent, as it were, a short time before his death. So it was actually built posthumously. And so I think he always had a great respect for law, great respect for trading, for rights, for civic, you know, for the correct form of civic governance. And that was important. And, you know, he comes at a time where everything's sort of in his favour, really, you know, sort of the lending and the luxury trades, the mercery, the role of merchants is beginning to change because alien merchants have begun to be forced out of London by the time he arrives and thereafter. We also see the Italian banking houses gradually shifted out from lending. It was Edward I who really started to make an inroad. But by the time Whittington is lending money in court, the English kings are looking to English lenders, and he's prominent.
And you mentioned the fishmongers earlier, but does he make any enemies during his time as mayor?
Probably he certainly made enemies of the fishmongers. Probably the greatest enemies he made were the brewers, and fishmongers and brewers, I think, were pretty tough groups of people, and you know, they've been described by other writers as part of the victualler's interest in London, and the victualler's interest was the regular. I mean, if you said that mercers and fishmongers were often at it in terms of trying to get their man to be mayor, they both were actually part of wider groups. So we would see the mercers sort of, I suppose, allying with drapers and tailors and one or two other trades, whereas you see the fishmongers often allying with the brewers, with fiddlers, other victualler trades, and you get these two blocks of interests. But I think it would be the brewers that he had the most difficult runs with. I mean, he took them to task in the mid-1410s, and then very much so around about 1415 and 1418, 19, over the sort of the illicit sale of contaminated ale, of ale that had been diluted, ale that had been barley or whatever had been stored and was mildewed or rotten, you know, which was causing sickness. And they were profiteering, and they were very arrogant. And he was determined to bring them to book, so much so that, in fact, he got into such a face-off with them around about sort of 1421, that his own friends were actually saying, look, you need to back off here. You know, your health is in danger, is at risk here. But there were also people, I think it would be right to say, in the city and in other trades who felt, actually, it's not all about you. You know, what you're doing here, while we broadly agree with it, and you're right, it could have repercussions for the rest of us. We need to get on with our trades and our lives, so don't rock the boat too much. And of course, he also, under Henry V, he was selected by Henry V as what was described as the only man in London that was trustworthy enough and experienced enough to head his investigation into usury, which is a curious thing, because there would be other writers who would say, well, Richard Whittington indulged in usury. It's just the term that you deploy.
Now, a little bit about Richard's personal life. He marries the daughter of his former master, doesn't he?
He does. And he's in the household of his former master for many years. In fact, one of the things that nobody's ever been able to sort of demonstrate with any lasting sort of permanence was where he went to live after he left the household of Ivo Fitzwarren. But you're right, Ivo Fitzwarren has a child, Alison, and Whittington marries her in 1402, and it is a very powerful relationship, because they've known each other through their lives, and they develop a joint vision. And that joint vision, and one of the things I found fascinating about this period, I found five or six really sort of strong examples of leading mercers and other leading merchants in the city who actually worked closely with their wives. They worked in tandem very often, you know, whether they were making donations to churches or to almshouses or to the edification or re-edification of buildings or whatever. And he and Alice developed this vision for St. Michael Paternoster, and that took some years to actually unfold. In the very early days of that, she died, and it was an extraordinary relationship. And I think it points to the progressive nature of it. And it's not just that, they also became affiliated to mercery guilds in the town or the city of Coventry at that time with another couple who were their close friends. And so this shows that it was a wider relationship, and that, you know, it's families of particular trades very often, in fact, almost overwhelmingly, married people, you know, the sons or daughters of people who were in the same trade. And you could say that happened here, although Ivo Fitzwarren actually was soldier, mercer and lender and many other things.
Absolutely. And Richard himself dies in 1423. He dies without children. What happens to his wealth?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, that's the key point, isn't it? That he dies without children. There is no heir. And, you know, his wife has died before him. Sir Ivo has died some years before him, 1414. And Here you have a man who, by the time he encashes all of his money and his assets and his chattels, it's estimated somewhere around £7,000. And he sets up a team of four key people led by John Carpenter, who he'd known for a few years and became his chief executor, and with whom he wrote the will over a period of 2 years before his death. And effectively, what he created was something that was quite remarkable. He created not only the passing on of his entire wealth, and remarkable because it's been spent and invested over six centuries by the Mercer's company, by his own company, but also, he, to use a modern term, he created in that small group what I would describe in modern parlance as a task and finish group. He recognized that although he created a list of the things that he wanted to do, and many of those were actually done very, very quickly, you know, whether they were the giving of alms, the building of a wing at St. Thomas's, as it was described, for single mothers, or whether it was building, improving sanitation and these sort of things. The really striking thing is he said to these four men and gave the final say on this to John Carpenter, most of this is going to take place after my death. And once I'm gone, I'm gone. And what's going to happen is things I've never heard of or been aware of will happen or come to pass. And I want you, and I'm giving you the authority, the executive authority, to make those spending and investment and donor decisions in my permanent absence. And that was a really interesting thing to do. It's that entrustment of this extraordinary sum of money, which is, I mean, I've never got into the game of trying to say, well, what's that exactly worth? But today it would have been worth millions by comparison. And it's an enormous gift in volume, but it's an enormous gift in the sheer breadth of the way it was distributed. And here we are, six centuries later. I mean, it's his 600th anniversary at the end of March. Here we are on the brink of that. And we still have a Whittington Hospital, a Whittington School. The Mercer's Company are investing in all sorts of social projects. And they were doing that, even before his death, but certainly as a result of his will, we're able to expand that hugely. And I've been doing that work ever since. That is a remarkable personal and a remarkable institutional act of charitable giving over an enormously long sustained period.
Now, this is the big question. How did he become the subject of a pantomime?
Yeah, it is, and it's an interesting one. And I always say to people that the important thing you need to know is if you've seen the pantomime, if you enjoyed the pantomime, you need to find out about the real man. Oh, was there a real man? Yes, there was a real man. Yeah, and here's the book. But more than that, I think the pantomime is very interesting for a number of reasons. One, I think it does give us an insight, which we both were discussing at the beginning of the podcast, that he is actually saying to people, look, I've done, or what we find people saying about him is that he's probably done a number of these things that are actually attributed to the pantomime character. So did he have a cat? I don't think so. But would a houseboy who is an apprentice, but looking after parts of the house of his master at that time, have cats? Almost certainly. It's 20 years since the Black Death and rats. Rats are a permanent feature of filthy, dirty, London. So he probably would have been responsible for that, for going into the cellars and the hallways and into the yard. And the cat in at this time in medieval life, but also mythology, is the cat. Cat could be looked both ways. It's as a sort of an icon or an adage of witchery. But more commonly, it's associated with very good luck. And I think the cat is introduced on reasonable ground after his death as something that helped him make his fortune. It was the measure of his good luck. So it's an icon. But I don't think we should read too much into it, even though people have found, small statuettes of cats here, there and everywhere in Gloucester and London and so on. But I think it's a charming part of the story. But what the story does tell us is it tells us it was an allegory, really. It was pointing people to the fact, look, however poor, and he was assumed to be very poor, he wasn't, of course, but however poor you are, you could make your name in London. If you got on the road and you came to London and you had your wits about you and you were honest, you could make your way. And the myth, the pantomime myth, has him offering his cats or his various cats to rid the ships, the vessels of foreign traders, assumed to be Italian, by the way, of their rat infestation. And of course, he traded with Venetians, with the Florentines, Milanese, throughout his life. And that's how he made his first fortune. So it's an important allegory. And if it's a means to introduce children to medieval history, that's fantastic. That's wonderful. But what happens is that I think probably the core of your question, and probably the real answer maybe you're seeking, is that he dies in 1423, but within 15 years, we're already hearing of him. Somebody who's called in sort of the ultimate merchant, you know, the son of Merchandy. That's right about 1437, 1438. We don't know who that was anonymously. But really from about the 1530s onwards, people are talking about him. They know about him. So that has been handed down. That's been handed down formally. People will know of him because over the decades after his death, we will have seen his good works come to fruition, not least through the offices of the Mercer's Company, but also through the institutions that he'd funded before he died. So his name will be well known. He would have been well known as mayor four times, and all of that has been handed down. And that's why, if you like, I think sort of Elizabethan writers, dramatists, playwrights began to sort of hook into him and think, actually, there's a remarkable story here. And even their stories, the pantomime element of this, I mean, we move from history to pantomime really much later, you know, really in the 19th century, the pantomime takes off, the late 19th century. It's compelling, and it's a compelling story which has a great deal of truth in it.
Now, I'd just like to say this, you know, this book is a really impressive piece of research. It's so incredibly detailed, not just about Richard's life, but about life in England more generally. What was the most important thing that you kind of came across during the course of your research? Is there anything that surprised you?
It surprised me that, I mean, I knew sort of London had been very turbulent, and London, not just because of Black Death, but in the 1360s, throughout the 1360s and the 1370s, and even an occasion in the 1380s, London had recurring pestilences. And I was particularly struck by the way people had coped with that, but mostly the sheer economic recovery that London was able to sustain, despite the fact that England at large was in an economic depression for much of that time. So while places like, you know, Newcastle and Bristol, Chichester, the Essex ports, Hull, suffered, Gloucester, we find London almost able to reinvent itself. And he's part of that reinvention. He pops up here, there and everywhere. And of course, I think probably the other thing was his relationship, the intimacy of his relationship to the three English kings, and the fact that we know that when Henry IV, who he'd known and supplied to as a young man, came to the throne in 1399, 1400, that Whittington was very concerned that he would be persona non grata and that he may be imprisoned because he was deemed to be so close to Richard II. In fact, one of the first things that Henry IV did is he appointed Richard Whittington to his King's Council, a council of wise and pious men. And all three of those kings at the very heart of this extraordinary period of medieval kingship, if you like, and turmoil and the Hundred Years' War. Here is this man who's a common thread all the way through that and is so close that not only does he start off as a supplier, he becomes a lender. He then becomes appointed. He gets various sinecures. We see him as the mayor not only of London, but the mayor of the Westminster Staple, the mayor of the Calais Staple. He's actually overseeing the import of wool and cloths and other things into London along the Thames. Makes more money from that, and he makes more money because he's so efficient in saving the money that the king was losing in tax revenue over many previous years. Here's a man that knows what it's all about, gets his act together, gets the Exchequer's act together, but also actually takes his slice. And I suppose the thing that fascinated me finally was that he never wanted to be involved in politics. He liked politics. He wanted to be where the action was, one step removed, maybe only a yard away, but not necessarily involved. So the mayoralty is seen as civic in his eyes, not political. So he eschewed the notion of serving in the House of Commons. He attended the Commons, I think, only once in his lifetime, maybe twice.
That was Michael McCarthy. His new book, Citizen of London, Richard Whittington, the Boy Who Would Be Mayor, is out now, published by Hearst. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.